tell me everything I'm not. Don't tell me to stop.
Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI in New York. Radio, broadcasting on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, Texas, and KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Also on other community and college radio stations. On Code Pink Radio today, we bring you economist Jeffrey Sachs on the status of diplomatic efforts to end the war in Ukraine. But before that, let's go to Code Pink Congress. Focus on the midterms with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, Scott Horton of Antiwar.com, and Eric Sperling of Just Foreign Policy. First, a news update from Wei Yu. Wei is the coordinator of Code Pink's China is Not Our Enemy campaign.
Yeah. So on Monday, President Biden and Xi Jinping met during the G20 summit in Indonesia. They've met previously when Biden was vice president to Obama, and this is the first time that they met as heads of state. This is a huge victory for diplomacy, and this is a huge victory for peacemakers everywhere. Important dialogues between Beijing and Washington had stopped since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan in August. This was a huge provocation for China because it altered the diplomatic status of Taiwan and also challenged the One China policy, which is the red line for China. And after this slapped in the face, Beijing halted important dialogues such as climate change and poverty. And even leading up to the meeting on Monday, Politico ran a story a couple of weeks ago about how Chinese officials were showing reluctance to move forward with the meeting. Their attitude was, you keep shutting us down and refuse to show good faith, so why should we bother talking to you at a negotiation table? And that's really a big stark contrast for how the mainstream media depicts China. They often paint China as they're just looking to cause trouble or show aggression, but really they just want their voice to be heard and want their red lines respected. And isn't that just the most human thing? And now the mainstream media were caught by surprise that the meeting went so successful. We've all seen the headline of President Biden saying there need not be a new Cold War. And he does not think there is any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is also set to visit China soon. And communications between Beijing and Washington is back. During the meeting, Xi Jinping said this quote, humanity are confronted with unprecedented challenges. The world has come to a crossroad. Where to go from here? This is a question that is not only on our mind, but also on the mind of all countries. And I think that's really just the message of our campaign. China is not our enemy. Our enemy is climate change. Our enemy is poverty. And when diplomacy fails, the world suffers. But when diplomacy succeeds, we can cooperate and tackle all of these great challenges that we face as humanity. So if you would like to stay updated with our campaign, I'm going to drop some information in the chat really quickly. But yeah, some good news for tonight.
Thank you. And we need that good news. Thank you so much, Wei Yu, the coordinator of our China is Not Our Enemy campaign. Madea had hoped to join us tonight, but she, as many of you know, is on a busy national book tour, international as well. She's in Canada tonight promoting the book that she wrote with Nicholas J.S. Davies, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. She wanted to talk to us about opportunities, post-midterm opportunities to press the Biden administration to take Cuba off the state sponsor of terror list. She thinks that, well, she's been in meetings with people in the State Department, and now that the Democrats can give up on Florida ever becoming blue, or at least in the next 4 years, it looks like, you know, the Republicans swept Florida. So she's hoping that President Biden will no longer be listening to a relatively small group of people who want to continue the embargo and this state sponsor of terror list. She might have also addressed what happened in Brazil. Good news there with the election of Lula, defeating Bolsonaro, who really wanted to savage the rainforest, a carbon sink we all need. And President Biden, the next day after Lula's election, he congratulated him. And I was just reading today how officials within the Biden administration had basically told Bolsonaro, you better not pull a Trump on us and claim that the election was rigged. You will never get help from us. But, you know, I think with Biden's framing the world as a struggle between democracy and autocracy, he very much saw Bolsonaro as representing a Trumpian faction. Phyllis Bennis is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, focusing on the Middle East, U.S. wars, and issues at the United Nations. Phyllis will update us on the effects of the U.S. elections on Israel, including an update on the Israeli elections, the possible impact of a Republican-controlled House on the war in Ukraine, a lot to update us there. With missiles flying in Ukraine, and the impact of European protests to demand diplomacy, not sanctions. Also calls from the chair of the Joint Chief of Staff. So, Phyllis, the floor is yours.
There was a vote in the United Nations calling for support for a request from the General Assembly of the UN to the International Court of Justice, asking for an advisory opinion on the legality or illegality of what they are identifying as the prolonged occupation of Palestinian land, meaning the occupied Palestinian territories, including occupied East Jerusalem. And the yes votes, there were 98 countries who voted yes. Most of NATO voted no with the US and the Brits. But of the countries who voted yes, included Ukraine, which was an interesting notion of recognition, perhaps, on the Ukrainian side of realizing what occupation really looks like and what needs to be done to end it. But given the dependence of Ukraine for US and NATO military support, as well as economic support, it was an interesting expression of independence for them to vote to support the resolution when the US was leading the opposition against it. So good, bad, and ugly to sort of introduce this. The question of the broader issue on Ukraine, we do need an immediate ceasefire that is not based on the balance of forces on any particular day. A ceasefire is not the same thing as the long-term negotiations that will be required. Today, there was a release by Zelensky, President Zelensky, of a 10-point proposal for peace. It's quite vague. It's quite broad. It was released at the G20 meeting in Bali, but it's significant for a number of reasons. One, that it's reference to the withdrawal of Russian troops and cessation of hostilities, meaning a ceasefire, did not specify from where. So whether they're talking about a complete withdrawal from all of the areas controlled by Russia or only the territory that has been seized by Russia since the war began in February of this year, very unclear. A lot of other things that are quite vague, but the fact that he released a set of requirements, none of which seem to challenge any of Russia's red lines. That was, I think, a significant move forward. So there are some opportunities here. I think we're looking at an opportunity to press Congress much harder right now around the need for a diplomatic track. the Biden position expressed in the last couple of days, as well as that coming from the Pentagon, from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and from the Defense Secretary, all pretty much parallel that letter that was issued by the Congressional Progressive Caucus that was seen as so outside the pale, right? And suddenly that's kind of the legitimate position that's under discussion in all of these Washington arenas. There are both military and political reasons why they may be shifting their position. The economic reasons, the $65 billion that we've spent already on Ukraine, Biden just asking for an additional $37 billion. The military reasons, clearly that the notion that Ukraine is going to be able to win some all-sided victory in this war has been pretty much debunked. And I think that this is the moment when we can really be very effective in winning some congressional support for a stronger call, not the kind of tentative reaching out and touching that we're seeing now, but a stronger call saying that we must have a call for an immediate ceasefire and a commitment to whatever diplomacy it takes to bring this war to a halt. In Palestine, I think most of you will know that we're in the midst of seeing a major escalation of Israeli violence and assaults on Palestinian lives, Palestinian lands. There have been more Palestinians killed this year than any year since 2005. 28 of them have been children. 800 children have been injured this year. The UN has already accused Israel just a couple of days ago of using excessive force specifically against children. So the conditions on the ground are much worse. The new government that was just elected is the furthest right-wing government Israel has ever seen. And it's important to recognize that it's not an outlier government. It's very much reflective of where public opinion is in the country. And unlike here, where you have young people being the most progressive, the least racist, the most open-minded, it's the opposite in Israel. So among Israeli Jews, the most racist, the most anti-Arab, the most Islamophobic, and the most violent are the young people. It's really tragic in terms of what it says about the future. But it does mean that this far-right government that includes the right, the far right, the extreme right, and the fascist right is very much representative of where public opinion is. There are now some real potential openings here in the U.S., again, in response to this. There are a number of forces within the State Department and some in Congress who are already talking about how if Itamar Ben-Gvir, the farthest right of this collection of right-wingers, is given one of the top ministries, which is quite likely he may well get the police ministry of all things, the public security ministry, that they will not talk to him, they will not engage with him, that it may turn out that it will be somewhat easier to get members of Congress and others to be willing to critique the unchallenged aid to Israel that continues despite all of this, when there's this embarrassingly overt fascist presence within the Israeli government. There's some optimism that I think we need to have. One quick thing is that the FBI today just announced that they are opening an investigation of the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, which is something that has been demanded by the Palestinian community and by the Palestinian rights movement since the day that Shireen was killed. The U.S. has refused and refused and refused. Today, they finally acknowledged that, yes, they are going to investigate rather narrowly, only on the question of whether U.S. arms may have been used in the attack that killed Shireen. But that's a major step forward. The Justice for Shireen Act, which now has 19 signatures, should be much easier to get more signatures on. So that's another thing where I think we have some real openings. At the international level, at the UN, there's some real motion forward on the question of not just recognizing Israeli apartheid as the appropriate framework, but looking at what do we do about that. And specifically, the question of reopening the Committee Against Apartheid. There's not only the leadership of South Africa and Namibia, but a number of countries, particularly the newly progressive governments in Latin America, in Chile, Brazil, and Colombia. There's interest from all of those governments in joining in that effort. So I think, again, public pressure there is going to be very important. And it's a new moment where, despite the really horrific conditions on the ground, there is some reason for optimism that may go forward on the international diplomatic side. And I'll stop there. We can get into more in questions. Thank you.
So here we go. Thank you so much, Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. It's always a great pleasure to have you provide all this information and analysis on Code Pink Congress. And we're going to be asking questions of you later on in the hour. Now I want to turn our attention to our next guest. To challenge endless war, we need a strong coalition. We need a diverse coalition. Scott Horton is the director of the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org. He's the editorial director of antiwar.com, host of Anti-War Radio for Pacifica, KPFK in Los Angeles. He's the host of the Scott Horton Show podcast on scotthorton.org. He's also the author of Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, and more. Scott will be discussing the role libertarians can play in elevating the anti-war message in the Georgia Senate runoff, as well as the next presidential race and anything else he wants to talk about. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here. I hope everybody can hear me okay. And hi to my old friend, Phyllis. It's been a little while since we've spoken. I'd like to yield the balance of my time to her to go ahead and keep talking about whatever she's saying there. I miss interviewing you. We got to do this again sometime. Listen, I'm very happy to be here. So antiwar.com is 27 years old now, next month. And I came in a little bit late, about 2004. But essentially, the core of our mission is we're extremely anti-government, free market libertarians. And at the core of the state is the warfare state. As Mr. X explained to Jim Garrison in the movie JFK, what's all this about, man? It's the war power, and who has control over the war power? So we want as little war power as possible to go along with the rest of the power that we want as to be as little as possible. So another aspect of being libertarians, of course, is that we're about 1% of the population, and I don't mean the rich. I just mean the very few who agree with each other here about this. And so on one hand, we'd like to make the whole society libertarian. But on the other hand, at least from my point of view and from antiwar.com's point of view, first things first. And I know that I can't convince people to change their entire political perspective or even their personal identity about who they are and what they are to what I want them to be instead. That would be way too much to ask. And frankly, it's not necessary. What I need from people is to just share my priorities, which really are great and smart no matter who you are. So what, at antiwar.com and at the Libertarian Institute and in my faction of the movement, our priority is always trying to oppose the very worst things the most and first. So yes, we are against the welfare state, but mostly that means we want to kick bankers off welfare. It means we want to abolish militarism and the military industrial complex. We want to separate business and state and destroy cronyism and corruption on behalf of the rich, because that is what is the worst aspect of government intervention in the economy, is doing favors for the connected at the expense of regular people. And then, you know, of course, the warfare state is the biggest and worst and most important part of that. It never closed it down ever since World War II. And as you guys well know, the doctrine has been, since the end of the Cold War, global hegemony. Even Russia and China may not be independent from the American Empire in the post-Cold War era. And so that's how we got ourselves into a new Cold War right now. And one that, as you guys, I'm sure, recognize, is at least ratcheting up the tension. I don't know if it's making nuclear war likely, but it's raising the likelihood of nuclear war to higher than it's been since before I was born, since 1962, higher than even 1983 in the height of Reagan's brinksmanship in his first term, I think is clear. And what I want to do as a libertarian and as a leader of my own institute and at antiwar.com is I want to try to forge coalitions around the most important issues. And so, for example, for 20 years, we've been running Phillips Bennis and Pat Buchanan right next to each other, as long as they're making a solid point, right? And we featured Nicholas Davies and Medea Benjamin, 10s and 10s of times, if not hundreds. We've been featuring Davies for years. And so we're extremely, the fact that we're libertarian almost has nothing to do with, if you read antiwar.com, you don't really know who we are. We just try to feature the best anti-war stuff from all over the place that we can find. And we have very high standards too. You don't find kooky stuff. It's all very good stuff. And, but we're trying to build essentially and set an example of building a coalition that is only ideological in the barest sense that, you know, you favor human decency and you understand that it, this is not the natural course of events. It does not have to be this way at all. We've allowed certain people to make these choices to make it this way, and it can be undone. So now this brings us to the problem of our current partisan politics, right? Is you have typically what happens is whoever's in power, the group of people, the citizens who are represent the other party, the party that lost, get mad at the government, right? So like in the 1990s, the right wing was anti-government because Bill Clinton was in there. And then when George W. Bush was in there, it's not that progressives completely gave up on the idea of the welfare state and the regulatory state, but they certainly were totally against the regime and the torture state and the unitary executive and all the lies and all the torture and all the war and everything that the Bush regime, you know, represented at that time. And then, of course, the right wing loved it, but then they switched. When Obama came, they became all very anti-government again. But then we had this funny wrinkle in time where Donald Trump came and the government hated him even more than progressives hated him. And the CIA and the FBI counterintelligence division framed him for treason with Russia, which no matter where you stand on the political spectrum, that just was not true. But they were acting essentially as antibodies trying to protect the state itself from its new elected leader. And liberals and progressives, by and large, sided with the CIA and the FBI and the national security state because anyone to protect us from that goon, Donald Trump. And I'm not defending Donald Trump from anyone's perception of him here. I'm completely against the guy. I wrote a whole book condemning him for genocide in Yemen and the rest. So he's just as guilty as the rest of them. Don't anyone get me, you know, misunderstood there. I'm just talking about the effect that he had on the left, because he made the left and progressives identify so closely, even with the worst parts of the state, as long as they were standing against him, as we've seen with the rehabilitation of George W. Bush, for example, by, you know, mainstream liberals. That guy from the Media Matters the other day, I praised him in like honest good faith for condemning W. Bush and saying, oh, this is, looks terrible that Bush and Obama are condemning misinformation together, because of course he would never condemn Obama, but he said George Bush just lies so much. And I said, hey, good for you for not backpedaling on Bush just because Bush is anti-Trump, as so many people are on the left are doing these days. So we've seen then, like, where we should have a robust anti-war left, at least in the House of Representatives, there should be, I don't know, 15 or 20 people who give a damn. And instead, we got four, and then they all roll over and back down on a moment's notice as soon as the Twitter swarm comes for them for saying that we should negotiate. When we have a hot proxy war right on Russia's border, and the fate of all of humanity hangs in the balance. But peer pressure and social psychology says that, in fact, I forgot the quote, was from a congresswoman, a Democratic Party congresswoman recently was overheard saying, oh, but how would it look if we proposed negotiations? Well, it would make you look like a hero, right? But in their social circles, that will mean that they're radicals, that maybe they're leftists, that they're anti-American, that they love Russia and hate Ukraine or whatever. They're terrified of the perception if they fight for peace. So that means a couple of things. It means, first of all, that the anti-war left and real principled progressives who care a lot more about the issues than they care about the Democratic Party, you guys have a huge row to hoe in terms of mercilessly pressuring liberal Democrats from the left and explaining to them how it is that you just absolutely will not stand for them taking the George W. Bush, John McCain line on Eastern Europe or on Yemen or whatever it is. We're the Democrats. It's the only thing people like about us is we're less worse on war. That should be y'all's narrative on pressuring the left. And then that means that me and the libertarians and the few paleo conservatives and other non-interventionist right wingers, and we have this huge challenge to try to really, you know, educate and inculcate and corral the America First MAGA conservatives, or to the right of the conservatives, if you want to call them that, to the poorer than the conservatives, the lower social class than the conservatives. If the conservatives, it's all the country club guys. These are the guys that work for them, you know, and they should be completely anti-war. And MAGA and America First should not mean we want to leave Russia alone so we can pick on China instead, or we want to leave Yemen alone so we can pick on Iran instead, or something like that. But of course, as you guys, I'm sure, all recognize, the Republican Party as it exists today is still George W. Bush's party. It is Mitch McConnell and John McCain and Lindsey Graham's Republican Party. And, you know, they are to the right of Joe Biden in the worst way on Ukraine. For example, right now, here's your appropriation bill. You better sign it. And it's more than he asked for. And all of that kind of thing is Mitch McConnell's take. So there needs to be, and I'm open to ideas, because this is, I think, the most important project in America right now, frankly, is forcing a civil war on the right.
You've given us a lot to think about in terms of building coalitions and pressuring those who purport to be progressive to say, stop all the war funding. And you're very entertaining. Thank you. Next, we have Eric Sperling and Hania Jadat of Roots Action and Middle East Alliances with Progressive Democrats of America. We'll do the introduction.
Thank you, Marcy, and thank you, Scott. My goodness, host of Anti-War Radio for Pacifica 90.7 FM. Honor and a privilege to introduce our next guest, Eric Sperling, who is the Executive Director of Just Foreign Policy. Earlier in his career, Eric worked as a senior advisor and counsel to the offices of Congressman Ro Khanna and Congressman John Conyers. He has a Juris Doctor from Georgetown University Law Center. And Eric will talk about the impact of midterms, the geopolitics in the Middle East foreign policy, with a laser focus on Yemen and Saudi Arabia. So take it away, please, Eric.
Yeah, thank you so much. And good evening, everybody. This is an incredibly difficult speakers to follow. So I'm going to have to take issue with the booking on this, but, you know, I'm going to do my best. A lot of what Scott is going over kind of overlaps with some of the same work. You know, Scott's been one of our really fantastic kind of, right-leaning voices on Yemen. And I thought we would, talk a little bit about Yemen and Saudi policy. I think, you know, we're still waiting to see how this election is going to fully play out. Part of it is because of the very thin majority, the thin majorities on both sides. There wasn't exactly the pro-Trump wave that was expected. The kind of Trumpian wave was something that some folks thought would work to, you know, peace activists' advantage on certain issues like Ukraine. That wasn't necessarily the case with Saudi Arabia. And so I think we're kind of getting a sense for how this is going to play out and where some of these Republican members are going to land on some of our key issues. You know, from our perspective, and as Scott mentioned, the number one issue, one of the most important issues in the world would be the Yemen, is the conflict in Yemen that's been going on for over 7.5 years. We've been working on that both as a staffer starting back in April 2015 and made a lot of progress. I see lots of activists on this list who've made huge contributions to that over the years. And recently, you know, little by little, we've been able to limit U.S. support for that Saudi-led coalition. Unfortunately, you know, it was Tony Blinken who was in. Tony Blinken was actually in. He was actually in Riyadh to announce back in April 2015, you know, full U.S. support in terms of weapons transfers and intelligence. But little by little, we've been able to chip away at that using different congressional maneuvers. And, you know, the U.S., you know, Biden actually, when he came in, announced that there would be very limited, that they would limit U.S. support to only defensive support, not offensive support. But unfortunately, that has not been clearly defined, and the support that the U.S. is giving is enough to allow the Saudis to remain in Yemen, continue their bombing campaign, and continue a blockade that essentially prevents Yemen from conducting normal economic activity and is probably the main factor in why Yemenis have up to about 20 million people who are dependent on aid and who are facing hunger. So Some of you may have heard, there's been an effort that Scott mentioned as well called the War Powers Resolution. We passed a version of it through the House and Senate under Trump, who vetoed it. And we have a new version that would end all U.S. support for that Saudi coalition. And we're hoping that we have over 120 co-sponsors in the House and Senate on that already, including about like a dozen Republicans so far. And, you know, given that Russia, that Saudi Arabia made this decision that was perceived as being helpful to Russia by raising, you know, cutting the OPEC production, and which is perceived as you know, being an intent to help Republicans win and Democrats lose, you know, there is a lot of sentiment. There's been a lot of statements from even more pro-Saudi or hawkish members against Saudi. So the big task now coming out of this election is to force that vote in the Senate, and then pass it in the Senate and pass it in the House and send it to President Biden's desk for signature.
Hey, what's up, man?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can
like,
dig it.
Stop right on.
On Code Pink Radio is a well-known economist. Jeffrey Sachs is a public policy analyst and director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. He has served as an economic advisor to governments in Latin America, Asia, Africa, Eastern Europe, and Russia.
Welcome, Professor Sachs.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Professor Sachs, you've been pushing for a diplomatic resolution to the war in Ukraine for months now and thought the Biden administration was wrong to refuse to negotiate with Vladimir Putin before this invasion. Do you see any evidence that the White House has come around to your point of view, that there is no military solution to the war in Ukraine, only a protracted war that risks global nuclear annihilation?
I see a lot of people coming around to my point of view. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was very explicit that we should be negotiating. I've spoken with European leaders in recent days. They know that we need a negotiated way out of this. We had the progressive members of the U.S. Congress who were beaten back, but they were absolutely on the right track. We have a number of the Republicans, what will now be a Republican majority Congress, that have said very clearly, we can't go on doing what we're doing. What the White House wants, well, they keep saying it's all Ukraine's decision, which is either very foolish or very cynical. But the implications of this approach are devastating for Ukraine, first and foremost. What they're doing is putting Ukraine in between two superpowers. This is a war between Russia and the United States, the way that it is going right now. The Ukrainians die in the war. The U.S. funds it, arms it, Ukraine gets destroyed in the process. And anyone with eyes open could see this coming. Anyone with eyes open that wanted to avoid it could have avoided it. In fact, I begged the White House before this war broke out, negotiate over NATO. That's what this has been about for 14 years since George W. Bush Jr. absolutely inexplicably and unacceptably said that NATO would expand to Ukraine and Georgia. We just have played with Ukraine's fate, and Ukraine's in the middle, and it's going to be without heat and power this winter. And General Milley said very clearly, now's the time to negotiate, and the White House should listen to their chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
I find it hard to believe that Milley would be out there on television or quoted in the New York Times talking about diplomacy if he didn't have a green light from the Biden administration.
Well, I'm not so sure. And I'm not so sure that there's one clear voice in the White House. Who knows? But all we can judge is by the performance, and it's bad.
It's terrible. And yes, these are very confusing times, because on the one hand, you have Milley saying we urgently need serious diplomatic efforts to resolve the war in Ukraine. You see CIA Director William Burns traveling to Ankara to meet with his Russian counterpart. On the other hand, the White House announces that it wants another $37 billion, what, $22 billion for military training, weapons, ammunition for Ukraine. This to be voted on in a lame duck Congress. Some might say, well, you've got to arm Ukraine because they need that leverage at the negotiating table. Code Pink, we say no. When you arm Ukraine, you discourage peace talks by giving oxygen to those who wrongly believe that a military victory is possible to the last Ukrainian. Your thoughts?
First of all, General Milley said military victory is not going to happen. We should listen to him. He's absolutely clear. Code Pink is completely correct on this. And it's just shocking or phony. I don't know which it is for the U.S. to say, we don't decide anything. Our checkbook and our arms inventory is open, and it's the Ukrainian government that's going to decide whatever. When, if they would just spend 1 minute thinking about this, they'd understand that this war is about us, and that we have to actually come forward. It's not even a matter of Ukraine and Russia negotiating. This is about the U.S. military alliance on a long border with Russia, period. That's what this is about. And it's been about that for the period since 2008. The United States helped to overthrow a pro-Russian president in early 2014. So we definitely gravely aggravated our meddling in all of this in 2014. Of course, like so much else, that story is never properly told or reported. But this war will end when the United States stops sticking it into the eye of Russia and sanely says, let's make a little space so that Ukraine can live and survive. We don't have to test every weapon system we have right now on the Ukrainian people. We need to pull back. And the idea that we have no aims other than whatever Zelensky says, and we're supposed to give another $40 billion on the basis of this, when our security is threatened, when you see Ukrainian missiles falling on Poland and the Ukrainians say it's Russian, which Of course, it was not. They lied about it before, after, during, and all of this could trigger terrible escalation that would be, of course, devastating for the world. And we're supposed to just keep shoveling the money and the arms in this? It's ridiculous. It's a horrible foreign policy failure of this president, and it's inexcusable. And I hope that Congress would not vote another penny without asking some questions. We've already given vast sums. The world's a lot more dangerous. Ukraine's a lot more destroyed. And so far, no questions have been asked. And now they're asking for another $40 billion. No, thank you.
If Congress does hand over or allot another $40 billion, that would bring the tab to $100 billion, more or less, for Ukraine during this past year. This is so dangerous, particularly in light of the fact that we now see Ukraine's President Zelensky calling for the U.S. to launch first nuclear strikes on Russia. Now, he backtracked on that. I watched him. I watched him on YouTube say that. And then he backtracked and said, no, I didn't really mean that. Then, as you mentioned, these missiles that hit Poland, he was blaming the Russians. Well, we know that wasn't true. So my thing.
Let me give you another hint. Who is shelling the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant? Now, that's a power plant that the Russians control and the Ukrainians want to recapture, and it's being shelled. Are the Russians shelling the plant that they control? I don't think so. Now, I've been briefed on this also. This is almost surely the Ukrainians shelling this plant, and it's extraordinarily dangerous, and everybody lies about it, and we just go on. So we need to stop the lying. Absolutely. Because this is getting more and more dangerous and out of control. And the White House owes some honesty to the American people. By the way, when they start giving the honesty, I'd like to ask them about the Nord Stream pipeline as well. Because President Biden said on February 7th, if Russia invades, the pipeline is over. And then he was asked, well, how are you going to do that? And he said, we have our ways. Secretary Blinken said, after the event, this is a tremendous opportunity now to wean Europe from Russian energy. And by the way, sell a lot of American gas to Europe. Come on. We're in the middle of an extraordinarily dangerous war, open checkbook. The Ukrainian people are dying. We say we're doing it in the name of Ukraine. They're about to evacuate Kherson City that they've just recaptured because it's absolutely unlivable. Apparently, they're going to also evacuate Nikolaev next door because it's not livable right now. Look what we do with our friends. What great support we are to them. We put them right into the middle of a war. We're loving them to death the way we loved Afghanistan to death or Vietnam to death or so many other countries. Come on, let's have some sense and bring peace to this place. And also, isn't it time we focused on some of the problems in the United States? After all, this country is also in a mess.
And yes, we have a polarized country. 100 million are in debt, medical debt. We have 10% of our population that is food insecure, does not know where their next meal is going to come from. And here we are pouring, about to pour $100 billion into a protracted war on the other side of the globe. So, okay, what would a diplomatic solution look like? If we were going to resolve this, what would you envision as a realistic solution? In other words, you know, Zelensky has said, oh, we're going to fight until we recapture all the territory, including Crimea, which where Russia has long had a naval base. Do you think Ukraine will give up demands that Russia leave the Donbass, where civil war has been underway long before the Russian invasion? What about the issue of NATO and neutrality? I didn't hear that in Zelensky's 10-point peace plan that he announced. I didn't hear anything about that. So I'm wondering where we are with that. And do you think that Russia would ever withdraw an inch from the territory it has taken in Ukraine? So what would be acceptable to all stakeholders in this?
The basic issues have been clear before there was a war. And there were three issues on the table before this war that could have been addressed to avoid the war. The same three issues were on the table in March when Russia and Ukraine came close to an agreement that the United States, by all reports that I've heard, talked them out of. And it's the same three issues that are on the table now. The first and most important is if Russia leaves, they don't want the United States filling in with NATO, period. So this has been the core from the beginning. And the United States doesn't have the decency to say we're not going to expand NATO. That's to save Ukraine, saying that, by the way. That's the compromise that saves Ukraine, because Russia is going to fight to prevent NATO enlargement to Ukraine, period. And so we never should have recommended this. That's the first item on the agenda. The second item on the agenda is Crimea. Crimea has been the home to the Russian fleet in the Black Sea since 1783. Give me a break. And before we overthrew Yanukovych, or helped to overthrow Yanukovych in 2014, Yanukovych, who was trying to balance between the two sides and not have Ukraine suffer a war between the U.S. and Russia, was saying, well, Russia will have the rights to Crimea at least till 2041, and then with options for renewal. That was the pragmatic approach that a pragmatic president was trying to pursue. Now Zelensky says, oh, we're going to recapture every inch of it. Well, over all of our dead bodies will be the truth, because that is not going to happen without complete escalation to Armageddon. So the second issue is de facto Russian presence in Crimea, as it has been since 1783. And everybody knows this. Anybody serious knows this. But Zelensky, for whatever domestic political reasons, says things that just build the pressure that for escalation to complete disaster. And
well,
I wonder
how long will the Biden administration put up with Zelensky? That's what I'm wondering.
And we sit there sucking our thumbs as this thing escalates to, even Biden said that it is on a path to Armageddon. And then he was quickly hushed up. Oh, don't say that. Don't tell the American people such things. Don't scare them. But, you know, even he said it a few weeks ago. So Zelensky, no. President Zelensky, you're not going to retake Crimea militarily, except over all of our dead bodies. It's not going to happen. General Milley knows it's not going to happen. I suspect President Biden knows it's not going to happen. It's time for the president to be presidential and tell the truth about these things. Then the third issue that has been on the table, also from actually Ukraine's independence in 1992 onward, and then especially after Yanukovych's overthrow in 2014, is the Russian concentrated areas of the Donbas, Donetsk and Lugansk. And the idea after 2014 was an agreement. It was called the Minsk Agreements. And Minsk II said that there should be autonomy for those regions. And the Ukrainians signed it, and then they ripped it up. They said, we don't like it. We don't want to do those things. And Europe was supposed to be the guarantors of Minsk II, France and Germany. They turned their eyes. The United States didn't want to press. This is our government in Kyiv. And so there was no solution for the Donbas region. And before this year, this could have been settled on the basis of the Minsk II agreement, which only called for autonomy. It called for special arrangements signed by both sides. Then Russia upped the ante It said, okay, now they're part of the Russian Federation. Then they added two more regions. Well, this is not exactly going in the right direction. This needs to be negotiated. I would not accept that these areas are all going to be Russian. I would not accept that at all in the negotiations, but we're not going to have to. This is what negotiations are about. That's why we need to start the negotiations right now. But we need to understand three issues on the table. One is non-NATO enlargement. Second is Crimea. And third is the Donbas. This is the basic issue. It's been the basic issue all along. We could have avoided this war by negotiating on these points. And this idea that it was a concession to give to Putin that NATO wouldn't enlarge, it wasn't a concession. It was sanity. That why should we want to push a U.S. military alliance right up against Russia's borders? Well, only if you have neocon reveries. That's the only consideration. Otherwise, any sane person in this country would know that's not a good idea. That's pretty reckless. Why don't we chill out a little bit and not have a war over it?
I'm with you 100%. Professor Jeffrey Sachs, what about China? We know that President Biden recently met with the leader of China, and they had a cordial meeting. Do you think China holds the cards here?
Well, the situation with China is the following. First, China would like this war to end. Second, China does not want NATO to enlarge. So the same issue we've been talking about is relevant for China. Why? Because these neocons are trying to enlarge NATO, which I hope people remember is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They want to enlarge NATO to the Pacific. And this is a kind of nuttiness that actually was shown at this year's NATO meeting when they invited Asian leaders, Asian allied leaders to NATO. How reckless can one be? This really is the neocon vision that U.S. military alliances encircle the world and encircle China and encircle Russia and so forth. And that's the path. So my point is to come back to your question about the role of China. China does not want this war. But China does not want to underwrite NATO enlargement at all. And that's why the Chinese government has rightly said, not wrongly, but rightly said all the time, that we need a negotiated solution that also respects Russia's security needs. That's not cynical. People should understand what that means. It means that NATO doesn't enlarge to Ukraine. Very simple. And that's the terms on which China will help to be a guarantor for peace.
Thank you, economist Jeffrey Sachs, for being our guest on Code Pink Radio. Also, a big shout out to the other guests, Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, Scott Horton of antiwar.com, and Eric Sperling of Just Foreign Policy. I'm Marcy Winograd for Code Pink Radio, broadcast on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, Texas, and KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, also on Spotify and iTunes. To learn more about Code Pink, visit us at codepink.org and join us on Code Pink Congress the first and third Tuesday of the month when we organize for peace and demilitarization. Until then, work for peace. Thank you.
Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say Cold War,
we say Cold Pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say Cold War,
we say Cold Pink.
Cold Pink for freedom, Cold Pink for peace, Cold Pink till hunger and war have ceased. Cold Pink for women, for
p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse, family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties and your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
Max Politics is moving to Friday. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette and the host of Max Politics here on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Our show is moving from Wednesdays to Fridays at 5 p.m., so check me out then with guests including elected officials, advocates, candidates for office, experts on a wide variety of policy and political issues, and more. We're going in-depth with newsmakers, analysts, and other great guests every Friday starting in August at 5 p.m. here on WBAI.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a celebration. The award-winning Midnight Ravers can now be heard every Friday from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. So wake the town and tell the people. We'll continue to present the best in music, history, and social commentary, along with expert discussion of the important issues and events of today and yesteryear. So keep it locked into WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
Hello, I'm Margaret Kimberly, executive editor of Black Agenda Report. We're very happy to present Black Agenda Radio on WBAI. Ever since 2006, Black Agenda Report has provided news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. BlackAgendaReport.com presents essays, articles, scholarly analysis, a book forum, and poetry. Every week on Black Agenda Radio, we speak to activists, writers, thinkers, and community leaders discussing local, national, and international news. WBAI listeners are an important part of the Black Agenda Report community. You'll hear a new Black Agenda Radio segment here every week. Thanks for your support. We look forward to bringing the best of Black Agenda Radio to WBAI on Fridays at 5 p.m.
What's Going On with Felipe Luciano returns next week, coming up at Democracy Now! Special with Juan Gonzalez. And let's all wish Felipe